But we get things underway here on this Monday afternoon by welcoming to the program an Oscar-winning producer, writer, director. He's created television shows like 30-something and My So-Called Life, and is responsible for films like About Last Night, Glory, Legends of the Fall, Shakespeare in Love, The Last Samurai, and more. He's got a great new memoir out called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. We're happy to be joined this afternoon by Ed Zwick. Well, I have to tell you, I love the book so much. I've read it twice now because I love, as a movie fan, reading about the process, and that was great. And then when I knew you were coming on, I wanted to go back and read it again to make sure I didn't miss anything. And in my other day job, I'm a high school theater director, so it's great to connect with a fellow theater kid from the days back in Winnetka.
Yeah, how great that you are involved in high school theater. That was ground zero, not just for me, but basically for all of us. You know, I think that in some way, everything that I have done has been a feeble attempt to recapture the passion of what those days were.
Well, I thought one of the great things about the book is this, and you mentioned it, that writing it helped you realize what you learned through movie making. But I can see so many parallels. What I learned from reading the book applies to teaching, and I would think it applies to a lot of jobs. So the book is not just for people who love movies. It's a great way to learn, I think, about working with people.
Yeah, and it's funny. I've had people reach out from Silicon Valley, from different law firms I think collaboration and creative relationships are definitely at the heart of what I was trying to get at.
Now, you've spent your career seeing your words come through other delivery systems with some very talented actors. Was there any trepidation in stepping into that first-person role and speaking for yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you write for others, you can be quite provocative and personal because you're protected to a certain degree. There's a Chinese firewall or a veil between you and these much more attractive, better lit, better dressed people up there. And, you know, generally, there people just don't make that leap that associate those words. That, you know, they think the piano has written the concerto. And so you say so you're safer. But when you start to write in the first person, there's a kind of vulnerability that you start to feel and some different challenges about authenticity. And for me, it was very much about that, saying, okay, if I'm going to be authentic about my own life, it obliges me to be authentic about some others. And that's also taking a risk, which is the fact that some things are less than attractive. Some are embarrassing. Some are, you know, revealing. And I just had to bite the bullet and do it.
Well, a couple other things I would note to you. Do you feel like a real writer now? Because that's what real writers do. They write a book.
Yeah, I have to confess. When I was in college, I wanted to be George Orwell. I wanted to write essays, and I even after college I worked for the New Republic for a while, and I somehow thought that might have been my life, but it didn't have for me that same kind of fire that the theater had and then movies have, except that as I've gotten older and continued to read Rebecca Solnit and Michael Lewis and these, you know, really extraordinary David Graham, these great writers, I have always felt that was real writing in a way that screenwriting was not slumming necessarily, but it was skating on, you know, between certain areas. And it was only 120 pages with a lot of dialogue and a preformed structure. And this was really deep end of the pool. And so I wasn't convinced it was going to be a book. You know how we all have files in our computer that we name certain things? Well, mine was B-K, and which is to say I didn't want to actually call it a book.
Not really committed to it then, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to offend the literary gods. And certain religions don't want to say the name of God either. And so that's how it began. I also know that books were really important in my house. My mother was an inveterate reader, and I became one, and always have been one. My wife is, and that this was a big swing, but something I was really immodestly proud of by the time it came out, and people actually seemed to, you know, get into it.
The other thing I learned from the book, among others, is that your wife Liberty, clearly an angel who walks among us.
Well, you got to, you know, accept that autobiography is the greatest form of fiction, and you know, I think she's given a bit of a pass in the book to, you know, when I tend to name only her fine qualities, but she's quite something, and I would not have been able to have done half the things I've done without her. I would have done another half, however, but I don't know what those would have been.
Well, let's go back sort of to the beginning. You graduated from Harvard. You got into Harvard Law School, and then got a fellowship that sent you to France. And a chance meeting on the street certainly changed the course of your life.
Yeah, I mean, the decision not to go to law school was the decision that was the thing that changed my life. I think meeting Woody Allen on the street certainly gave it a different direction, or a sense of direction, because I think had I not met him or had that experience, it's quite possible I would have gone back to New York. I'd been offered a job doing something very, very small, insignificant at the Public Theater, but that probably would have led to something else. I have friends who took that course, and I suspect that's the course I might have been on. But meeting him was an opportunity to go inside of film. And when I say inside, I don't mean just on the set, but seeing the process of script to screen, talking to someone as a director who really was in the moment of learning it himself. He'd made a couple of movies, but they were still somewhere in that liminal space between sketch comedy and film. And he was about to cross over. And the crossing over was Annie Hall. And this was that space, this was this transitional moment between those movies and that movie, which became truly an integrated movie and unique in its own regard. So,
to the fact that he was a writer who admittedly didn't understand everything that went into the filmmaking process, that opened some doors for you to realize, hey, I'm a writer, I can lean on other people who know their craft better than I might.
And I can learn from them, that I can surround myself from people and make it a learning experience, a kind of learn as you earn experience, and really and just, you know, take advantage of a craft and a tradition, and a tradition that is actually very comfortable with a kind of mentorial structure of passing it down from others to you. And I was lucky enough to then encounter that soon after in film school, where when I arrived at film school, you have to understand the moment. It was like it was the early 70s, mid 70s, and all of these guys were still alive. Raoul Walsh, John Ford, Orson Welles. I mean, literally, these people would come to AFI and talk about their lives and talk about the craft. And they had invented it, really. They had been the guys who had really ended up, you know, not just championing it, but fashioning it. And they wanted to pass it along. And we were sitting there just soaking it up. And somehow to try to, and it's maybe self-serving to consider myself a part of that tradition, but we were encouraged to do that. And maybe one reason I wrote the book was to take that same role for others in generations to come. I believe there is a very important tradition of American narrative storytelling that I believe in, and that I think has been one of our greatest contributions to the world.
You also came into the orbit at AFI of Nina Foch. What did she do for you as both a mentor and a friend?
And a scourge. She was tough, Nina. She took no prisoners, but she was brilliant. She was part of a tradition, which was the Uta Hagen, Stella Adler, Actors Theater, Lee Strasberg, New York idea of acting as a craft and acting as a as an art. And she was a priestess of that. And we sat there and she blew our minds. She confronted us and made us actually get up and act, which was, you know, terribly difficult, you know, in her under her eye, but also watched us direct others and critique that. And finally, just gave us benefit of a worldview that was post-Freudian, that was political, that was cultural, and also she had been part of that same tradition. She'd been a studio player. She'd done coaching of actors for George Stevens. You know, and so you know, again, she was inviting us into this club.
It was also there that you met up with Marshall Herskovitz and started what you call the longest running partnership in Hollywood. How have you two managed to keep it together for all these years? What's the secret of making that relationship work?
Extraordinary good luck. I think a certain amount of forbearance. I think our friendship is at the center of it. Some love and respect. I never had brothers, and he certainly has become that in my life. He had two brothers growing up, so he actually had a better sense of how to do that. Very quickly, that both with his strengths and mine and some compensation for our shared weaknesses, that I think together we realized we might actually be one complete artist. And we accepted that. And there was a certain recognition and admiration of each other's abilities and a humbling of your own, some willingness to be self-abnegating at times, which is a very healthy thing in Hollywood, frankly, or maybe for any artist. You know, it was just, we really never looked back. I mean, from we were struggling together for several years and bitching and moaning and whining and, you know, thinking it'll never happen. And then when it happened together. It was because of something we did together. And then another thing we did together that just gave us, it wasn't hard to, see that was something that was going to work. You know, as time went on, though, we also realized that it might be healthy to be apart at different times in ways that one doesn't necessarily able to do in a marriage. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just going to see you in 9 months, pal, and I'm going off to Georgia to make a movie, or he's going to Rome, and okay, I'll hold down the fort with the kids and the employees and the family jewels, and you'll just go have an adventure. And that gave a certain amount of, what's the word I'm looking for? There's a need, I think, at times for men to assert a certain amount of individuality. I think the things that are often problematic in a relationship with men and women are our intimacies and accepting that and dealing with the intensities of that. And, you know, some men deal with it by going to play golf for 6 hours, three times a week. And you deal with it different ways. As some in the old days in the 19th century, it was sea voyages. But in this case, we've just known that we had that it was something that we wanted to keep going, and we just sacrificed certain things in order to have that.
What was the spark that made you realize that writing about fictionalized versions of the life that you and your mm-hmm. family and your friends' families were leading that led to, I still think, one of the best series that's ever been on television in 30-something?
Well, I think that you know, I would go back. I mean, it depends how far back you want to go, because God knows you know, when you look at what Arthur Miller and what, you know, William Inge and the playwrights were doing in the 1950s, they were talking about family drama, or even back to O'Neill. This is an American, you know, convention. And then, you know, Larry Kasdan and John Sayles wrote a couple of great movies. It was, you know, Secaucus 7 and Big Chill. And they had done that in movies, right? And Bergman had already done Scenes from a Marriage, which was, you know, searing and unbelievably insightful and difficult to watch. So the thing is, nobody had done it on television. Television was this, in comedy, they had started to talk about things, ironically, in All in the Family. And there had been in a willingness to actually, in a lighthearted way, try to pierce some of those intimacies, but not in drama. And drama was, it was abysmal. It was, I'm sorry, it was, you know, Make Room for Daddy and Life and, you know, My Three Sons and all that stuff that was so false and just risible that I used to look at it and think they were talking about aliens. It was literally just really impossible. And so there was a lane there. There was an opportunity to step in. We didn't think of it that way, not then. I mean, we were just schmoes saying, we want to do this about ourselves. And we weren't, you know, prognosticating, oh, there's a gap in the public's appreciation of the family. No, none of that. It was just, hey, here's a fun idea. And nobody will ever want to do it, but we want to do it. And it was kind of sophomoric in this idea of making friends and taking serious our lives. But the other analogy, and this is to go all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, it had to do with watching Woody Allen and his relationship with Diane Keaton, which I had observed after they were already apart and yet friends, which I then saw in the script and saw how he had taken this fodder, this base metal, and turned it into art, and really appreciated her and her lovely qualities and her problems and his, and that I think was also instructive.
You brought on board a young writer who we had a chance to talk with about a year ago, the great Winnie Holtzman, and she told part of the wonderful story about how I think both you and Marshall talked to her about creating a story from the eye of a perhaps unreliable narrator that became mm-hmm. My So-Called Life.
Yeah, we did. And Marshall and I had, in our separate ways, actually tried to write about adolescence and never really been allowed to by some of the powers that be, because it was too threatening, I think. But things had changed at a certain moment. And what Winnie did, which was so disarming, was that this voice that she found in first writing her journals, and that became Claire Danes, it was so engaging and so relatable that no matter how transgressive and inappropriate some of the things were that she said or did, she was so, you know, you couldn't help but love her. And it was a It was really one of those moments, again, where you have just, you know, found gold, you know, and that's Winnie, although we'd already been working with her for a while on the show. But it was Claire Danes walking into a room, and Wilson Cruz and Jared Leto, and, you know, these really talented people, you know, just happening to come together at the right moment.
We're talking with Ed Zwick here on Downtown. His new book is called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. The movies beckon, and you make your first film with a version of a sexual perversity in Chicago. But we got to change that title. The public won't buy that. And it was also one of your first opportunities to come head-to-head with, well, let's just say, the character of actors and their mercurial nature.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'd had this experience on 30-something. It was so kumbaya and so collegial and so loving that there was nothing that actually seemed to be really bumpy in that. And movies can often be different in that the stakes are very high and things are compressed into a very narrow time period, and everybody comes at it with a certain suspicion, a certain amount of fear, and no one more afraid of being mishandled or mistreated than the actors, because they've had that happen in the past. No, I had an experience which I talk about in the book, which is pretty funny, because of how it ends with Jim Belushi, because we ended up being very close friends, and the process worked, but it was not before an experience that found us standing on an L track in Chicago yelling "fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, no, fuck you," while the rest of the crew, were watching or thinking that the movie was going up in flames. But in fact, it was necessary. It was necessary for each of us to see the depth of our passion and our commitment and our willingness to go to the wall. And having measured that in each other, I think there was some respect that came out of it, and then a friendship.
Glory, first of all, as a history teacher, I thank you for that. I've shown the film in classes countless times. It's powerful, but also you work so hard to make it historically accurate. But also learning about the environment that went on that set, and particularly with Denzel, with Morgan Freeman, and the realization that as a director, sometimes you have to be content with knowing you've created a situation where something magical can happen, and maybe it's best just to get out of the way and let that go.
Absolutely. And that was such a lesson to me, because the temptation to think of a director as being an autocrat and to be the utter authority figure who's determining things, in fact, over-determining them, it was so obvious that that would be not just limiting, but impossible. That what these guys had, what they knew, what they had inside was so beautiful, and of which I was going to become the beneficiary. So you become more of the midwife than the mother. And that's okay, because it allows you actually to focus on some other things, which as a director you have a real need to do in movies like that, with that scale and the logistics and the financial aspects and all of those things that are also the director's task, which is often why when you find a relationship with an actor and you have trust with each other, you repeat. That's repeat business, because each of you feels, oh, okay, we can let that part of it be its own component that's working, and let's focus on the things around us that need it. It's funny when you talk about Maine, though. I think about Bowdoin College and Joshua Chamberlain, and that story, which is maybe the best story, from the Civil War, better in some ways as a narrative than Glory. And when I was actually when my daughter was looking in colleges, I absolutely just wanted to go and see the statue to him there and everything.
Jeff Daniels was on with us and talked about how nervous he was. He wanted to get that accent right because he found out there were a bunch of Civil War reenactors from Maine who were there being used as extras. And that was the measure of success for him. Will they buy my Maine accent?
Yeah, and by the way, we couldn't have made the movie without the reenactors. We had reenactors come from all over the country, particularly black men, who knew the story and wanted to be part of it. And they were history teachers and lawyers and corporate guys, and they were athletes and soldiers, and it was amazing. That spirit informed it as well. It was a kind of ballast to the whole movie.
And I'll leave the Matthew Broderick story for people to read the book, because there's a lot to unpack there. But to me, the most heartwarming part of the Glory story is the story of Mr. McClendon.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, it is for me too. I think it may be my favorite part of the book. Certainly, he was somebody deeply, deeply important to me. Everybody in life is lucky if they have one teacher. In my case, I've had several. And we talked about Nina Foch already, and there was someone in college and someone else in high school. I've had several, but none more so than him, because what he taught, he was actually never an academic teacher to me. He was my homeroom advisor for 4 years. He himself was a history teacher and had an extraordinary sense of revisionist history as the only black man in a white suburb, in a white suburban school during 1966 to 1970. Think about what was happening in those years in terms of the King assassination, in terms of the Chicago 7 riots, in terms of, all of those issues. And he decided it was his job to do what he could to awaken the consciousness of not all of us, because, 25, 15-year-old idiots sitting there at 7:30 in the morning, bleary-eyed, are not necessarily open to conversations about race, but some of us were. And he identified those of us who were. You're nodding because you're a teacher, and you know when you're teaching that of those 25, there are maybe two or three who are really getting it.
And when you
And
connect with them, they'll
it
take you
makes
on that
all.
journey.
That's it. And he took me along, and I mean, he also did other things. He kicked my ass. He, decided he is the wrestling coach. He challenged me to go out for wrestling. Now, I'd been an athlete. I'd been a soccer player and been a baseball player, and that was all fine. But wrestling, I mean, really putting on that sweaty plastic suit and making weight and just rubbing up against those sweaty bodies on the mat in the weight room. I mean, who though wanted to do that, right? But he dared me basically, and he knew that I would be susceptible to that kind of influence. And it was turned out to be another of those things in life that really became important. Ironically, my relationship with Tom Cruise had as much to do with the fact that we'd both wrestled in high school as anything else.
Well, and Tom Cruise, that whole chapter on Making of the Last Samurai, phenomenal. Knowing the backstory of the hierarchy of Japanese acting, the work of Ken Watanabe, and well, you talk about Tom Cruise being such a force of nature, and you say he has what you call stomach brain. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I suppose it's just a an artsy way of talking about instinct. That sometimes there's a temptation to think of other people because they don't have the same language you do or the same fancy education as not necessarily being able to contribute to the same degree. But in fact, that kind of visceral reaction to art is maybe just as important or more important than any of the highfalutin intellectual stuff that some of us do. In his case, I think Tom Cruise has watched a movie every night of his entire life since he was 14 years old. I honestly think that's true because I know during the periods of time that I was with him that it was true. Even after working for 16 hours, that was a kind of devotional for him. And so he's internalized this rhythm of movies and its tropes. And the expectations of the audience and put himself in the place of the audience. And it's actually harder to do than you would think to do something like that. And it gives him something. It's people that have careers like that have reinvented their careers again and again and again. They do so for a reason. I'll tell you somebody else who's a friend of mine who's done it too, is Jamie Lee Curtis. Jamie Lee Curtis, comes from Hollywood royalty, began at a very young age, but her career has sort of just been reimagined so many times because she is inside the process and has this inner understanding of what entertainment is. And he does, and that's what he has.
And boy, Leonardo DiCaprio comes off as such a mensch, such a great person to work with, and your time together on Blood Diamond.
Not everybody who reaches that eminence can be that generous. They're maybe inhibited from being that way. He is he's grateful and he's self-deprecating about it. That isn't to say that he's unaware of, his role and his position in the business, because he is. But he's used it for good. These movies, at a time when there are so few movies that are grown up and that are complex and of scale, he knows that his involvement in one of those is going to actually be the guarantor, is going to be the thing that's going to make it happen. And he's used that celebrity and that position to accomplish that. And that's really admirable, too.
Somehow I missed Defiance when it came out. And after reading about it in the book, I said, I have to see this. And I watched it two nights ago. My God, what a powerful film.
Yeah. It's a movie that literally we first tried to make. It took us 10 years, basically. We wrote it and then couldn't get it done. And I had this kind of very interesting moment artistically where I rethought the story and found a way to tell it that I think was able to compress it and make it more powerful and poignant. And it's a story I'd wanted to tell a very long time. It's personal to, you know, my family. And it's, you know, a lot of movies you don't know why you've done while you're doing them. You think you know, but then you find out afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I guess that to have, you know, that's funny. I'm just sitting here thinking something. There was something of historical redress in doing Glory. There was something in historical redress about Samurai. They're not revisionist necessarily as they are trying to add to the public record.
Right.
Because in a time when there's division in the country and some people are only looking at Fox News and some people are only looking at MSNBC, when you make a movie, or by the way, now when history is sometimes being taught or the people are trying to control what kind of history can or can't be taught, a movie tends to be a kind of a Switzerland. I think a lot of people don't go to movies thinking they're going to see a political thing one way or the other. But in terms of history, it is an opportunity to take some responsibility for the public record. Movies, for lack of a better common ground, become that. And to do that for Defiance was important to me because there was an iconography just of the victimhood, all necessary about the Holocaust. But there hadn't been an exploration of the opposite impulse, you know, of resistance.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, it was important to me for that.
Well, it was tremendous. I know you've got many other interviews to get to, but it brings up a question I wanted to ask, which is, as you put this book out there with the idea, too, that young filmmakers will learn from this and learn from your experience, is there a future for serious films about grown-ups in this industry? And what will that look like?
You know, it's funny because, you know, you write a book, it takes a year, and then it's a year to publish. And even in these 2 years, it's even taken a further step away from that reality. Movies used to have this perch in the culture, this opportunity for grown-ups to find something that really spoke to them and that joined them, you know, that was a common experience. And the studios, once they were bought by multinational corporations and forced to adhere to P&L projections each quarter, is that they were unable to explain to their overlords the attempt to bring in an adult audience that was harder and smaller to get than 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds who were looking at, who were trained on a diet of comic books and were then looking to further that in movies. And when you think about how to make the most money and they decide that it's about trying to do something that is the most generally appealing thing, well, What is going to appeal most generally? It's going to be something that is inoffensive, something that is pleasing, something that is funny or fun, something that is pretty, you know, and loud. But it's not necessarily going to be challenging or emotional or threatening or confusing in the ways that the best movies can be. And they just sort of started to slowly back away from it. And then they got hit by an economic downturn, and then they got hit by COVID, and they got hit by strikes. And so you see that there's this thing that has happened where seriousness, such as it is, has become the province of the streaming services, but the streaming services haven't known what to do with it either, because they don't necessarily market each one and give each one the kind of individual attention that they need
right.
to reach a grown-up audience. And their subscribers are already in, and so how do they actually do that? And I don't think they've done a great job at providing that same kind of material. Independent films do it, but how many independent films really do break through to the public consciousness every year? Maybe 5 or 10.
Yeah.
And it's not 40. It's not like what used to happen when I do it in the book. I talk about just a particular year when I was really starting to really make movies, so 1979, 1980, where you couldn't possibly watch all the great movies that were made because there were too many.
Well, and there was also that urgency that it was pre-VHS,
yeah.
pre-DVD,
yeah.
that you had to get there and see them during that run in your local theater, or you might not be able to talk about them with anybody and they might just disappear into the ether.
And the ether is a place where a lot of things are happening now because of the streaming services who've decided, no, we're not going to run that. And we might own that, but no, never mind. And then no one runs it, and it sort of vanishes
yeah.
from the culture. And by the way, there have been several films that, because I like to think of something that I want to see that I cannot find,
right.
that I cannot see. I mean, maybe if I go on some backlog site online to try to find an old DVD, but it takes a real bit of research to come up with something, and many of them you can't come up with at all, and things are being lost hand over fist.
Right. Hang on to those physical copies that you thought maybe you wouldn't need in the age
exactly.
of streaming. I saw, too, you mentioned in the book you're working on a Stephen King adaptation for J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, we've just adapted a great book that he wrote called Billy Summers.
Oh, gosh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's just so amazing. Then it's not the it's not fantasy and it's not horror. It's rather in that world of Shawshank and noir that he has been in at times very happily. And this is a thing that we've just written. We hope for Leonardo DiCaprio to play. We don't know. The studio has read it now. They seem really excited. Steve has read it. He liked it too, which is the most important thing for me. You talk about Jeff Daniels wanting the accent to be right in Maine. I want the typewriter in Maine to like this particular thing, because we want to honor what he's done. So that I hope will be happening in a year or so.
Well, we didn't even touch on the epic story that is Shakespeare in Love, but read that and find out what Ed learned from it as well. A wonderful story early in the book about Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman, and with a cameo appearance by Hank, Henry Fonda. It's all captured in this wonderful book, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. Ed Zwick, I have enjoyed your work for so long. Great to read the book, and even better to talk with you about it.
What a pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
So much fun. The great Ed Zwick with us here on Downtown. Read the book. It is a fantastic. If you love the movies, you're going to love hearing some of those behind-the-scenes stories.